From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Do you have that smug, self-satisfied, you suckers go ahead and wait in line, but I already had my say feeling? Well, if you voted by mail or other forms of early voting, maybe you do. Still, most people will cast their ballots on November 4th, and both political camps are gathering legal armies to challenge possible irregularities. They're the legal armies of Election 2008, just one of the stories we're going to look at with Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi. Hello,
how's
Rob.
It going?
Things are great. Well, let's start out with a little math, Mary. As many as 10 white Democratic candidates for the House of Representatives in the South are counting on a surge of black voters to push them ahead on Election Day. So how is the Democratic Party going to fare in the age of Obama?
Well, if the black vote turns out, and surely it should, in this election, maybe those 10 white Democrats will get elected. It's always been an anomaly in the South that you'd have Republican congressmen or even conservative Democrats representing districts where there were a whole lot of black folks, especially Republicans, representing them. But this year, with the turnout, this may change, and then the Democrats will have a much larger number of people in the House of Representatives, which may present some problems because most of them are moderate to conservative, and so there may be some division there. But I think the Democratic Party will take the numbers, the overwhelming numbers, and if the turnout is what everyone projects it to be, that's what should happen.
Robert, we got a little bit of a clue of the dynamic after the special election in Mississippi in the spring. White Democrat Travis Childers took over a House seat long occupied by the GOP, thanks in part to black voters. So, you know, Childers and his challenger are now competing for a full 2-year term in the November election. But from the Republican perspective, with so many Republican seats either in play or, you know, people retiring, what could this do to the balance of Congress?
I think Republicans are, you know, are looking at a slaughter in the congressional races, and possibly in the Senate too, where they may get to a 60 votes there. What I think, just kind of bouncing off of something that Mary said before, that it is true that these you've got these candidates who are looking at the black vote helping sweep them in. And the irony is that even though the polls look good for him right now, even if Barack Obama doesn't win, if McCain somehow pulls something out, that just the incredible turnout of black voters, regardless, can still make a huge majority of Democrats in both the House and the Senate. Now, while it is true that because these people are running in otherwise conservative districts, they will end up running basically voting as moderate Democrats. But keep in mind this. They're going to have to run again in 2010, and they will not be able to depend on having a Barack Obama at the top of the ticket to bring out a huge amount of black voters again. So they are going to even though they are going to be dependent on getting into the office by having a huge black turnout, they are going to have to vote in a middle of the road way so they can make sure they can get reelected in 2010 when there might not be such a huge black voter turnout.
So what we're looking at is a greater schism in the Democratic Party, even if the party ends up with greater numbers between the blue dog conservatives and the more liberal progressives in terms
of the agenda, one of the things Republicans found out in 94 is, you know, when you're in the minority, you are very, very unified because you can break everything down to, like, say, 3 or 4 principles and that everybody's going to be on board with. Once you're in the majority, and you've, especially if you've got huge numbers, it's just natural that it sometimes can be a little bit harder herding all the sheep because you're going to have some blue dogs over here who are a little bit more conservative. You're going to have the hardcore liberal caucus over there, and as you know full well, I think it was Will Rogers who said that I don't belong to an organized party. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite sayings. Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I have to move on to another topic because this one is going to be huge. early voting states are reporting record turnout this week. Officials in Houston counted 39,000 votes on Monday alone, and that's double the amount for the first day of voting 4 years ago. You've got people voting in Florida, North Carolina, other key battleground and swing states. And so we're used to hearing about voter registration, people walking around and, scooping up those registrations, sometimes maybe getting a couple of Santa Clauses in there. But there are a cadre of lawyers ready to file challenges in case the contest is not settled the day after the election. So Charles Lichtman, the Democratic lawyer charged with keeping tabs on Florida, has said, quote, "On election day, I will be managing the largest law firm in the country." He's talking about 5,000 people. Mary, is this necessary?
Well, it depends. If Obama wins by a landslide, as predicted by some polls, or by 1 point, as predicted by others, you pays your money, you takes your choice, but most of them predict a large margin, then it won't make any difference, because even if the Republicans challenge some votes, there won't be enough out there for them to say that they can win. If he wins marginally, then, in fact, I think that there will be some challenges. And what the Democrats are doing is, based on what happened in Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004 and so on, and the recent charges of fraud in the registration process, is getting ready for it no matter what happens and getting ready to insist. I think they're right to get ready, since we can't really tell whether the polls are entirely accurate and that the landslide will be so overwhelming that it will be suffocating. And there probably will be some challenges, because there have been some instances where people have publicly said that they went out and registered voters that they shouldn't have registered and the like. I'm sure it's not a large number, but if the Republicans lose and it's by a small margin, I think that they would bring charges. And if Obama should happen to lose, clearly the Democrats would, under these circumstances, be filing charges all over the place.
Yeah, exactly, because the way it's looking right now is John McCain looks to, if I can start using a poker terminology here, John McCain is looking to draw an inside straight for a very narrow electoral vote win. It's more likely that Obama is going to have a comfortable to landslide win. But if it ends up being a narrow McCain win, it would quite obviously can come down to one or two states, probably one state. And yeah, absolutely, the Democrats are going to jump in. What I always think is interesting, though, every 4 years, you can predict it. The Democrats are going to accuse the Republicans of voter intimidation or voter suppression, and the Republicans are going to accuse the Democrats of a voter fraud and voter registration fraud. Now, I think in isolated cases, you might find examples of both. But it's fascinating that every time they all get into the regular talking points, and generally speaking, it ends up being isolated things and nothing widespread on either side.
All right.
Well, Farah, I've got to tell you that in 2000, I chaired the commission and we did investigated Florida. And under oath, we had sworn testimony from officials and people, and we found thousands of instances in which black voters who were eligible to vote were not permitted to vote. We called it the no count. That's why Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, which is supposed to have helped us to solve these problems.
All right. Fundraising. The Obama campaign announced it had raised $150 million in September alone, breaking all previous records. Now, Senator McCain actually went on Fox News Sunday, where he criticized what he called the, quote, broken dam of fundraising. Here's a little bit of him talking with Fox's Chris Wallace.
Senator Obama raised $150 million, I understand, during the month of September, completely breaking whatever idea we had after Watergate to keep the costs and spending on campaigns under control. First time since the Watergate scandal. And I can tell you this, that is unleashed now in presidential campaigns, a new flood of spending that will then cause a scandal, and then we will fix it again.
Go for it. I have to go. Look, John McCain is the Republican candidate. Fine, As I wrote on my personal blog, Ragged Thoughts, a couple of days ago, this is a perfect example why John McCain still drives conservatives absolutely nuts. The McCain-Feingold law that he was pushing for close to 10 years and finally got signed in 2002, it helped create the conditions that Barack Obama is taking advantage of now, because it ended up limiting the amount of soft money that would otherwise be in the race. It did, however, allow almost unlimited amounts of internet fundraising, and in fact, that was actually pioneered by John McCain in 2000, expanded by Howard Dean in 2004, and of course, Barack Obama has blown the walls off of this.
All right, Mary,
I got to get in on this.
You got 1 minute.
Late breaking news is that a lot of Obama's money came from huge donors. That was on the front page of the Washington Post this morning, and not from the internet. I also think
but
that
it's
McCain,
still 3.1 McCain, million individual
McCain,
donors.
Let me finish. McCain was a chump. When Obama decided to go back on his promise, McCain should have said, "I'm going back on mine," because what the guy did.
You're talking about public funding.
Right, it's public funding. And Obama paid no price. The white shoe liberals, who had been arguing all the time for public financing, made Obama pay no price in the media or anywhere else for having done it. And here was McCain in a Democratic year anyway, being outspent, all the rest of it, with everything else going for Obama. And yet he stuck to that. He should not have stuck to it. He was a chump,
all right,
basically. And that should be the end of the idea.
Guys, we have to end it here. And next time we pick up, we can also talk about what money the parties do or don't have. But
right.
Thank you for the vigorous discussion.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you. We were speaking with Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. And Robert George is the associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Before our bloggers take on the latest political news, we want to hear what flavor you have been bringing to our blog, News and Views. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Farai. How are you?
I'm great. And so, you know, it's October. I went out. I decorated my house for, you know, the fall. There are a lot of people focused on the election.
Mm-hmm.
But black college grads are looking forward to something else. What's that?
Homecoming season. For anyone who went to an HBCU, right about now is the time people go home for homecoming, as it were. Howard had their homecoming last weekend. Morehouse and Spelman Colleges convened this week in Atlanta. And Natalie McNeil of The Root offered 5 ways to hype up the fun while reducing the cost of homecoming, since folks have a little bit less money to spend this year. And we have the list on our blog. And we took an informal poll, as we sometimes do. 55% of those responding said the halftime show was their main focus at homecoming. 18% said the game itself was the main draw, and the rest chose the answer, "What game? I'd rather be tailgating."
Yeah, I think that if people were honest, there might be more in that category.
Exactly.
But let's move along to General Colin Powell endorsing Senator Barack Obama. What's the reaction on our blog?
Yeah, that was the most popular topic of the week. Let's listen to part of Powell's rationale for his endorsement as told to Tom Brokaw of NBC's Meet the Press.
He has met the standard of being a successful president, being an exceptional president. I think he is a transformational figure. He is a new generation coming into the world, onto the world stage, onto the American stage. And for that reason, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
So the reaction. On our blog, a reader named Glenda Alvin wrote, "I think Powell's endorsement is too late to really matter. Powell is a 4-star general who decided not to run for president because of his wife's fears of assassination. Obama ran in spite of those fears. He does not need Powell now." To which another reader named John Jay replied, "Before his interview on Meet the Press, I felt the same way. I was disappointed that it wasn't coming soon enough, but he hit all the key points. Transformational figure was the phrase that resonated with me." And Audrey Lewis wrote, "Any and all endorsements the senator can get right now are greatly appreciated because it ain't over till it's over."
All right, what else do we have coming up for folks on Election Day?
Well, we've got an interactive map that breaks down the electoral standing right now in the national and state races. We have profiles of all the key figures. We have insight from our political contributors, and we have posts from you each day as we get closer to November 4th.
Yeah, it's the countdown.
Yeah, 2 weeks to go. Less than 2 weeks.
I know. Do-do-do. Yeah, right. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from our studios right here at NPR West. We'll be right back. Now on to our bloggers roundtable. With us, we've got media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. Rob Redding, who maintains the blog Redding News Review, and Ali Akbar, president of Republic Modern Media and a contributing blogger at Hip Hop Republican. Hi, guys.
Hi, Farai.
Hi.
So this White House race is kind of rough, but not just between the presidential contenders. It's also between the press and the contenders themselves. So this weekend, the New York Times ran a story detailing trials in the McCain marriage. It reported on Cindy McCain's struggle with prescription drug addiction, her difficulty fitting in with Washington wives. Carmen, is this the kind of story that the Times should be running, or is it much more gossipy?
All information, I think, is relevant, especially when the right wants to talk about family values and talk about identity. If you're going to talk about identity, then let's talk about everyone's identity.
So there's also another issue. Time magazine columnist Joe Klein was banned from the McCain-Palin campaign planes. He's been a critic of the campaign, and in addition to reported pieces, he also writes opinion columns, and he also goes on TV and is an analyst. A campaign spokesperson for McCain said about Joe Klein, "We don't allow Daily Coast diarists on boards either," meaning the hugely popular liberal blog network. Rob, is it fair to take someone, a huge award-winning figure like Joe Klein, and say, you're not welcome?
No, of course not. I mean, well, you know, if the policy is that we don't allow blog, quote-unquote, I guess, or diarist or whatever, then that's the policy, or whatever the policy we want to put in place. We don't allow red, yellow, or blue people. But, look, you know, I think that the report is above board. Everything was done correctly by the Times. This is the kind of thing we want to know, as has already been discussed. We want to know about folks that claim to be great at family values, and we want to know as much about Michelle as well.
Ali, do you think it's a situation where part of this is about the blurring of roles? I mean, Joe Klein has been, you know, the man on the back of the bus and really been a reporter out in the field. He has done TV analysis. Sometimes he gets to run those cute little people meters. I mean, he really gets to do just about anything. And of course, he's the author of Primary Colors, which then became a film. And he wrote it under the title Anonymous. And everyone spent months trying to figure out who Anonymous was. So he's a very multi-talented man.
Right.
But is he someone who a campaign has to keep on, or are there distinctions where only kind of the beat reporters and the pool reporters have to be on the plane?
You know, with the economy the way it is, I feel like this is such a non-issue, but I think that the campaign has to have the discretionary right to choose who's on the plane and who's not. And if they choose to only have reporters who actually report and members of the press who are going to give the facts to the people later to be deciphered by op-ed writers like Joe, then, you know, I think that that's what's fair. I don't think that anybody is entitled to be on the plane with the candidate because he has, you know, so many awards on his bookcases.
All right, moving on. Sarah Palin, there's a lot out there, and here are some of the comments made about the governor by Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, and Keith Olbermann.
You know, that's just my way of saying I think that's a profanity to say, and I was answering with a profanity, but it's not really fair, and it makes it seem like I'm just addressing Governor Palin about this, and I'm not. It's really this whole entire theme that there's more American areas, or some people love the country, some people don't. So I guess what I meant to say was, all y'all.
This is the third time in 20 years, mm-hmm. Bush, yeah. Quayle, and now Palin, they have nominated a complete bimbo, which is a man or a woman.
Wow.
Besides which, Governor, exactly how on earth could you not have the correct answer by now? It's not like this is the first time you've been asked about the vice presidency and gone all Miss South Carolina on us.
Carmen, last reference to a beauty queen who just couldn't pull it together. People have called Sarah Palin a lot of names. And when Senator Hillary Clinton was getting called out of name, there was a lot of fuss, particularly about whether or not it was sexist. Where's the outrage now?
I think there is some outrage if you turn on Fox or listen to Hannity's radio show or check on the right-leaning blog. So I think there is some outrage from the feminist community. This is the same community that went back and forth and supported Palin initially, although her policies were completely opposite of Hillary Clinton's because of gender and because they were so angry at Barack Obama. So I don't think you can count on a sort of let's see, a concrete feminist outrage to pop up anytime there's an insult made. There are different factions within women, within women's ideology, I guess I should say, just like there is within anybody else. Women on the right are going to call out sexism. Some of us women on the left think some of these criticisms are absolutely valid, particularly something perhaps kind of witty, like the South Carolina comment.
But then you hear the word bimbo and you hear the F word, or rather you don't hear the F word because we don't use it on NPR. Ali, is that crossing a line?
It's definitely crossing a line. I was about to jump in. This isn't an issue of feminism or whether or not you're a woman. I'm a biracial male. I'm half Arab and I'm half African American, and this was offensive to me as an American. I don't think that a journalist like Keith Olbermann should be using rhetoric like this. And I think what Bill Maher said, you know, calling her bimbo, moronic, even saying that, you know, John McCain had to put a folder in front of his crotch because, you know, the surge is working or whatnot. You know, I think it's entirely inappropriate. And after the whole Hillary incident, there was a lot of us on the right who said, you know what, maybe there were some inappropriate comments made. And I wouldn't argue that it's just the right and it's the moderate. You see a lot of Clinton voters, ClintonForMcCain.com is a perfect example, who is calling out this stuff and we're calling out this stuff as sexist. And it's a shame that it's happening all over again, back to back.
I would disagree with you that there's a lot. Sure, there's a website, but I think the poll numbers are showing that those women are drifting toward Obama.
Rob,
but that has nothing to do. That has nothing to do with whether or not the comments made are sexist or not.
It has to do if they perceive them as sexist, and that to be a determinative issue in their vote.
Rob, let me throw Rob another curveball. What about class? It's something we don't talk about a lot, but there certainly has been an implicit deconstruction of class when you talk about Joe Sixpack, which is a phrase that Governor Palin has used. Has there then been a backlash against her because she's not a Cindy McCain? She's not rolling with millions of dollars, private plane, you know, necessarily the couture outfits. Do you think some people view her as also not quite classy enough for the White House?
I think that's definitely the case. There's an underlying tone of that. I can't believe I actually on the radio defending Sarah Palin, who I believe is an affirmative action pick. But I think the rhetoric is a little high in this ad and in what we've seen so far. And I think that they don't have to go there. I think she's just not qualified to be vice president. And I think that class is definitely an issue. I mean, anytime you talk about someone who's skinning and I don't know what to even call it, dressing animals, I guess, in the field and all of that, that kind of doesn't really equate to most average American women, especially.
We might have to go there if the economy keeps going that direction. So
we might have to
go back to squirrel stew, but, you know.
Watch out.
Anyway, moving right along with yet more campaign news. This weekend at a McCain rally in Virginia, a group of Muslim Republicans and a McCain worker confronted a man passing out Obama paraphernalia that insinuated Obama was a Muslim. Ali, what do you think the effect will be, if any, on the McCain campaign of a supporter, not a worker, but a supporter doing this?
Let's be honest, a McCain staffer, McCain campaigner, someone who's affiliated with the McCain, called it out and said that this was inappropriate, and that's the same thing I'm going to do. There are fringes of our party and fringes of the right that make inappropriate comments. Obama is not a Muslim. You know, some contend that he's never been a Muslim, and that's, you know, neither here nor there. And it does make us look a little, it's a big turnoff, and the polls reflect as such. So, you know, I'm going to call it what it is. It was inappropriate. It was hate. It was bigotry at its worst, but it's not something that reflects McCain himself or the campaign as a whole.
Carmen, you also heard General Colin Powell making a point of saying, so what if he was a Muslim? You know, why does he always have to defend himself against being a Muslim? Where are we now, years after the 9/11 attacks, in the middle of two wars, in terms not just of the plurality issue as it comes to race, but when it comes to religion? Have we moved forward or backwards?
I would say I believe we're in a holding pattern overall. I think right now, the good news for Obama and the bad news for McCain, we are so concerned with the economic picture. We are so concerned by the fact that we are fighting two wars right now. That has a different, the idea of whether Barack Obama is a scary, and I'm using scare quotes here, is a scary Muslim, has less impact than it might have in bountiful times, particularly in swaying an independent moderate view, a moderate moderate voter. But if you are on the web as much as I am and read everything coming from all directions, there is, I would say, it's more than a fringe on the right of center that
not
has
true.
Grave concerns
not
about
true.
A person's religion and what it would mean to have a Muslim commander-in-chief and what his alliances would be because of his religion, his particular belief in God.
We have, you know, just one member of Congress who is Muslim, and he happens to be also African-American, black American born and converted. And he has come out with a statement, Keith Ellison, praising General Powell's remarks about who is an American. It strikes me, Rob, that on November 5th, this country will still have Muslims, Christians, atheists, Hindus, Jews, any number of other religions that probably some of which I haven't even heard about.
Atheists.
Yeah, you know, and so these things that we're discussing are not going to stop when the election stops. So is there going to be a will to have a discussion maybe once politics is off the table per se and just really have a national, you know, meeting of the minds on what constitutes being an American?
It depends on if Barack Obama wants it. I'm not sure he does.
Assuming Barack Obama has won.
I assume that Barack Obama at this point is going to win the election. And short of a startling revelation where they can actually prove that he actually is a Muslim, which would be a problem for some people, which I'm not thinking is a problem at all. I agree with Powell. I've been taking that tact forever, saying that, so what if he is a Muslim? And I think that's highly offensive, that other them, that whole other them is so offensive. But back to the point of your question, there needs to be a dialogue. I'm not sure if there will be one. There definitely won't be one if John McCain's elected.
One thing that has come up, Carmen, is whether or not, and we've discussed this before, but I think it's good to take the temperature, whether or not there's a cult of Obama that is totally counterproductive, that people are just invested in, okay, I'm going to get the T-shirt, I'm going to, you know, go and talk about this all the time, but maybe not get deeper on the issues. What's your weigh in on how the cult of Obama is doing these days?
The good news is I think the cult of Obama is being swamped by those of us who are thinking and have made a reasoned decision. But does the cult of Obama exist? Absolutely. And perhaps even more fervently than the cult of McCain, Palin, which exists as well. But my concern is actually, and I don't know if we're really going to get into this, but I have heard some incidents of people doing hateful things who believe Obama's going to win and sort of exerting their muscle. Like, who do you think you are? You wait till Obama gets in. Some really crazy stuff like that.
Wait till my brother gets home.
Let me jump
Please.
In here. I noticed that she actually dodged the question and turned it into a cult of McCain, which, you know, I don't think that anybody on the far left would even say exists. But you're seeing that these Obama people, you know, what does Obama inspire these people to do? To raid motorcades, to shoot at McCain's bus, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the litany goes on.
I don't think you heard my answer correctly. I mentioned that there was indeed an Obama cult and that there is a McCain cult, and I would disagree with you that those on the right don't acknowledge it and, in fact, are trying to distance themselves from it, most people on the right anyway.
Oh.
I don't want to confuse lust for a cult. Just because you want to sleep with Sarah Palin doesn't mean that there's actually
exactly.
a cult for her.
That makes you American.
Yeah, your lust is my cult. There it is.
Oh, my goodness. We're going off on a tangent, and so I'm going to rein it in and say thank you so much for this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Rob Redding, who maintains the blog Redding News Review, Ali Akbar, president of the political online development company Republic Modern Media. He's also a contributing blogger at Hip Hop Republican, and media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. She was with me at our NPR West studios. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Dr. Drew Pinsky is well known for his advice to young adults on the racy MTV and syndicated radio show Loveline. Last year, viewers saw Dr. Drew help drug-addicted celebrities battle their addictions on Celebrity Rehab. The show followed addicted celebrities as they underwent detoxification and drug treatment at a facility in California. Well, VH1 has teamed up with Dr. Drew again for a second season of Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew. The season's cast includes actor Jeff Conway, Nikki McKibben of American Idol, actor Gary Busey, and Rodney King. The acquittal of Los Angeles police officers in Rodney King's beating precipitated the 1992 L.A. riots. In this scene from the show, some of the other participants try to figure out who Rodney King is.
I thought that the guy who got beaten up by the cops, Rodney King. That's him, right?
That's not him.
No.
He's an actor. He was in Boys in the Hood.
I thought he did sports.
I thought, yeah.
He's All-American. Basketball player?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. The kids.
How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, this is actually a very wrenching show to watch. I mean, folks here are really hurting. So how do you balance what could be seen as the voyeuristic aspects of what you're doing with the medical and psychological aspects of what you're doing?
Well, I'm so sort of bewildered by people who see this as a sad story, because the fact is this is a disease that afflicts 1 out of 8 Americans. This is a common condition. It is the disease of our time. People die of it every day. It's a sad disease that has a treatment, and the treatment is quite inspirational. I for one, am sick and tired of people talking about the treatment of a severe life-threatening medical addiction, the treatment of chemical dependency, or what some people call rehab, as though it's some sort of spa treatment. In fact, there are, because there's very little regulation on the residential level, some of it is only that. And so people do get very confused about what this is, what the disease is, how it's treated. And we thought it was time to pull the curtain back on that. And the fact is, the presence of the cameras didn't harm anybody. In fact, it seemed to inspire most, if not all, of the patients. And they get better. And I think other viewers will be absolutely transfixed and inspired by where they go with this. It's a sad disease. That's a fact. But to put people in an environment where they can deal with it in a realistic way and transform and get better, well, there's nothing sad at all about that. It's hard to watch, but all addiction is hard to watch.
Is there anything that makes it different for people who either are famous or have been famous at some point in terms of trying to get sober and stay sober?
Really, no. And in fact, the original I wanted to put regular people in with the celebrities just to make that point, just to show that we treat everybody the same. In fact, as soon as you treat an addict as special, you undermine their ability to stay sober. But as I was interviewing some of these potential sort of regular folks, so to speak, for the program, it became increasingly clear to me that they couldn't really render an informed consent. They did not fully appreciate what it would mean to be on camera and to be exposed in this way, while the celebrities fully understood it. In fact, Mary Carey, who was in the first season, sort of summarized it for me. Because every day I was sort of making sure that this wasn't troubling for them, they were okay, that the cameras didn't bother them. And finally, Mary Carey says to me, she goes, "Look, Drew, I've done everything in front of a camera. This is not a problem." And I thought, yeah, okay, you guys do understand what this is. And in fact, when it did air, I still had concerns that when it aired, it would shame them or expose them or make them feel bad. It didn't. It made them want to feel like they could be an inspiration to other people.
Well, we want to bring in Rodney King, who was on your show. And Mr. King, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah.
Hey, Rodney.
Thank you. Hey, hi, Dr. Drew.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
Excellent.
So one of the things we see in the show is you puking your guts out before you go into rehab. What brought you to the moment where you said, you know what, I'm actually willing to go on TV and show people my recovery? What brought you to that point?
Well, pretty much everything I do a lot is exposed on TV now anyway. And so I just felt that it would be best to, you know, show other people, not just kids, but, you know, the world, how, you know, this thing called disease is a struggle, and don't be embarrassed to, you know, get yourself some help. I feel if they see other addicts on TV exposing this type of thing, you know, that they'll say, hey, you know what, this is not so bad. Let me go get me some help. Because, you know, earlier on, you couldn't find help, or you just got teased about it and you died a real bad death. You know, it was real tragic.
Rodney, your voice sounds very crisp, and there have been times when you have spoken, you know, you obviously went through something that few people can imagine, being beaten the way that you were, having it end up on videotape, and subsequently having, you know, an entire city in flames over, you know, a fundamental difference of how they viewed what happened to you. But it happened to you, not to anyone else. And there have been times in the past, to be honest, when you haven't sounded so crisp. So are you sober right now?
Yes, I am sober. I've been sober for about 4 months now.
How does that feel?
It feels good. You know, once again, you know, I've been in and out of rehab, and you know, each time it's a different, it's a change. And this time it really was a, you know, a good experience for me. You know, at the age of 43, it feels good to be clean, you know, for 4 months.
Mr. King,
yeah.
You're a symbol of different things to different people, of injustice, of survival, of reconciliation. What do you want for yourself? I mean, now that you're sober in particular, what do you want for yourself as a man?
You know, just to be seen as a man and as a decent human being, not just some person who's running down the street, you know, drunk and running from the cops, you know, a person who was all about speaking peace and speaking of change, you know, for the world.
I got to say that I promise people will perceive him in this program the way he wants to be perceived, because that's who he is. And people will be surprised and pleased and delighted by this man, in my opinion.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both so much for coming on.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Drew Pinsky of VH1's reality show Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew. He joined us from NPR Studios in New York, and Rodney King joined us by phone. The second season of Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew premieres October 23rd on VH1. Not all of the epic stories in American history are well known. Consider the lives of the first African-American members of Congress. They served during the Reconstruction era, just after the Civil War. Historian Philip Dre tells their stories in a new book, Capital Men. NPR's Tony Cox got the chance to talk to him about his work.
Philip, welcome to News and Notes. It's nice to have you on.
Thanks, Tony.
Let's start with this. Congressman George White from North Carolina ended his term in office in 1901. He was the first to introduce an anti-lynching law, and it got him run out of office. I want to start there because the end of his term marked the end of an era, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's an era that began shortly after the Civil War, when Congress, in order to allow the former Confederate states back into the Union, insisted that they hold constitutional conventions, which would make it possible for black men to vote. And so that caused a kind of electoral revolution in the South. You suddenly had blacks not only voting, something that they were very enthusiastic about, but also electing black officials for the first time. So you had the beginning of a series of about 20 black congressmen who came to Washington from the South and served through the end of Reconstruction in the late 1870s, and then, as you mentioned, all the way up to George White, the very end of the century.
Now, you write about the first seven black members of Congress. What did they have in common beside their race? For example, they weren't all former slaves, were they?
The one thing that I think they had in common was that they all were very exceptional people. Some of them had been slaves. Some had been free blacks. What they had in common was a kind of a, you know, sort of ambition to lead and to serve.
Of these early black politicians, who stands out for you and why?
Well, there's several. There's a man named Robert Brown Elliott, who was a congressman from South Carolina. He was a little bit like Barack Obama in a way, in that he was his origins were a little mysterious. He was extremely eloquent and wrote beautiful speeches, and in fact gave a speech on the floor of Congress in 1874, where he was confronting the former vice president of the Confederacy in Congress and sort of won the day. And his speech was lauded all over the country, and they even made a beautiful lithograph of it, and he was kind of the toast of the town. And so he was an interesting character. Another one I could mention is Robert Smalls, who they called him the boat thief. He, as a slave, he was working on a Confederate boat, and he managed to steal it and deliver it to the Union Navy, for which he became kind of a hero in the North, and then sort of capitalized on that to become a politician after the war. And he was served a very long time from the Sea Islands District of South Carolina, and was just hated by the whites of the South. They always called him the boat thief for the rest of his life into the 20th century.
Your book, notwithstanding, history has not been kind, I don't think, to the first black congressmen, many of them being depicted as corrupt or buffoons. We know that that is an inaccurate stereotype, but is there any truth behind that representation at all?
Well, not really. In other words, you have to remember that, of course, the South was very resistant to the idea of Reconstruction, and the black elected officials were, in a certain way, the worst insult to them. The idea that their former chattel would become, come to occupy positions of authority was very insulting to them. And of course, the press caricatured the black legislators mercilessly. The truth, of course, was different, which was what bothered the whites in the South about the black politicians was not their ignorance, but rather their intelligence, because the blacks took very well, actually, to being politicians. They were fairly adept at it. They came to understand the legislative process and were really quite effective.
Well, to follow that point, how effective was the Reconstruction period, and why was it called the Glorious Failure?
Well, that's in a way a very good term, because it was very idealistic at first, and it was sort of glorious. It was based on a lot of very sort of nice democratic instincts about these new citizens. There were 4 million new citizens after the Civil War, making them equal, making them citizens, giving them the right to vote. There was an effort that the black congressmen were involved in to actually make it so that blacks would enjoy equality in what's called, public accommodations. In other words, riding on a train, seeing a play in a theater, eating in a restaurant. That did not succeed. That was sort of their thrust generally, was to kind of try to use the time they had to broaden the equality and the opportunities, really, for black Americans.
Now, black congressmen presented the case against the Ku Klux Klan. How did they do it, and what impact did it have?
I think it had a lot of impact, because one thing the black congressmen could do better than any white, however sympathetic, was that the blacks could really speak truth to power. In other words, when they came from, say, South Carolina or North Carolina to Washington to testify in Congress or to speak in Congress, they could say, just 3 days ago, I was stopped on the road by the Klan and they threatened to kill me. And I'm here now by the grace of God. And please, let's pass this Ku Klux Klan Act so we can get some federal help down there. So they really kind of, could testify, could sort of bear witness in a way that no one else could.
You make comparisons in the book between what happened during Reconstruction with the results of the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections a century and a half later. What are they?
After the sort of like over-the-top violence of the Klan seemed to fail, the South turned to a great degree to kind of like ballot box trickery and phrasing of voting laws that were meant to not openly defy the Constitution of the United States, because that would be too much, but rather to make it virtually impossible for black people to vote. There were all kinds of strange tricks, like marking the ballot boxes differently to confuse illiterate voters. There was something called the Understanding Clause, where a registrar could ask an applicant to explain or to understand any paragraph from the state constitution, which, of course, then left it up to the registrar to have total latitude about, oh, well, that answer's not right. So like white illiterates or any white voter could be passed, but any black could be turned away. And, of course, these kind of tricks, we see them again. They're happening. Even right now, there's something going on out in Ohio where the Republican Party is being kind of crafty about finding ways to basically make it sort of imposing on people to try and come and vote. And so we still see these kind of things going on. They're maybe more sophisticated now, but it's basically the same idea.
Congressman George White from North Carolina ended his term, as we said, in 1901. There was not another congressman, at least from the South, as I understand it, until when, 1970?
It was 1973 when Barbara Jordan and Andrew Young were elected. So, it was funny because George White, he's a wonderful character, and I loved including him in the book. He was the first person to advocate a federal anti-lynching law. And for his trouble, he got attacked by his home state, the white press in North Carolina, went after him viciously. And he fought back. He sort of exposed the kind of sexual double standard of, you know, you're complaining, you're making up all these things about sexual assaults on white women. Let's start talking about the actual consensual relations between white women and black men, and also the access that white men seem to want to enjoy with black women, and so on and so on. And this, of course, at that, you know, in the 1890s, this was like beyond insulting. And the campaign to get him out of Congress was intense, so much so that the day he left, the state of North Carolina declared a day of Thanksgiving. And White, of course, had a great sense of self-drama. And on his last day in Congress, he stood up and gave this speech that he called the Negro's Farewell, basically saying, you know, we've enjoyed being here, we've done what we could, and we'd love to stay, but, you know, we'll be back. And this was in 1901. And, of course, it took 72 years for another Southern congressman to set foot on the floor of Congress.
Philip, thank you very much. You did a good job on the book. I appreciate you sharing your time with us.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with historian Philip Dre. He's the author of Capital Men, the epic story of Reconstruction through the lives of the first black congressmen. Dre joined us from our NPR studios in New York.